I want to welcome you to It's More Than Free Beer, Thinking Philanthropically About Inclusion, Equity, and Diversity. I'm Megan Story. I'm the Web Project Manager at the Brewers Association. Just a couple housekeeping items. Please turn your phone back on to silent. Questions, there'll be a session, question and answer period at the end, but we need you to use the microphones throughout the room so the recording will include the question and the answer. And then finally, please use the app after this session to give the short survey a look at and tell us what you think about this session. It is my pleasure to introduce to you Dr. J. In addition to being a professor of communication studies at Randolph College in Lynchburg, Virginia, I also get to work with her as the diversity ambassador at the Brewers Association. So please welcome Dr. J.
Good morning. It's afternoon. Good afternoon. I was going to blame it on the time change, but I came from the East Coast, so that doesn't work at all. Good afternoon. As you heard, I'm Dr. J, and I am a professor of communication studies at Randolph College and also the first ever diversity ambassador for the Brewers Association. I was given that honor just about a year ago, right before CBC 2018, and this first year has been incredible. We've done some great things at the BA with the Diversity Committee. We've written and published a set of best practices for diversity and inclusion for small and independent breweries. These are freely accessible to BA members. You just need to log into the website and download them. We recently launched a diversity and inclusion events program to fund events that are intentionally cultivating diversity in the industry. We're in the process of reviewing grant applications now, but I can say with no hesitation, I am beyond excited about the response that we received from all of you, so thank you. We've just begun to collect some demographic data about operations at breweries across the country. If you have not completed the HR and operations survey, please do that. It has now a section on diversity, and that will help us to benchmark so that we can set our agenda going forward. And last fall, we held a summit with the Diversity Committee to establish our 2019 agenda. We are just getting started, and I am so excited to share with you the things that we are going to do this year. But honestly, aside from all of that, I think my most important accomplishment has just been traveling around the country, listening to all of you this year. And I have traveled a lot. Starting with CBC 18, I attended the State Guild Leadership Summit in DC. I spoke to the Masters Brewers Association of America via webinar. I spoke at the Beer Bloggers Conference and visited state guilds in Arizona, Montana, Georgia, Colorado, Washington, California, Ohio, Massachusetts, Texas, and Maine. In the coming months, I'll be speaking at HomebrewCon, visiting Minnesota, Florida, heading back to California, you're big, Pennsylvania, and Sweden. Because the example that we've set here in the United States has been so compelling that they invited me to come speak over there. I've met so many people, and you have shared so many things about your brewery that I acknowledge are probably not easy to share. You've asked me extremely difficult questions, and you've invited me to be a collaborator and looking for answers. And some of you have even started your own diversity committees at the state level and in the regional level. And I just want to take a moment to say thank you. Thank you so much for your generosity. And I mean this Without hyperbole or irony, you are changing my life. So thank you. Speaking of generosity, today I want to talk to you about the remarkable generosity, picked up the mouse, not the clicker, the remarkable generosity of Crackers that you specifically show through philanthropic programs. So when you help charities, when you support causes, when you raise money for your communities. And before we go forward, I just want to say a little thing about philanthropy. This word actually comes from Greek origins, means love of humanity, which I think is a beautiful definition. But when we're talking about philanthropy, we're talking about goodwill to fellow members of the human race, active efforts to promote human welfare, and acts done or gifts made for humanitarian purposes. And the reason I want to talk about philanthropy is because I specifically want to talk to you about two different types of business relationships that are formed by way of philanthropic activity. So if you've seen me speak on the road, you've probably heard me suggest that brewers should start utilizing their philanthropic programs to make relationships with underrepresented populations. But the more I make that suggestion, and then I finish talking and I think about it, I realize there's tremendous room for this to be mistaken. Because honestly, I'm not suggesting that if you just give away free beer to brownish people, they will come to your brewery. Right. What I do mean is to think less about the giveaway and more about thinking philanthropically, right? Thinking with the love of humanity. And specifically, thinking philanthropically to drive decision-making and action that works towards equity, inclusion, and justice. Now, you'll notice I did not say diversity. And if you're a reader of my Twitter or any of my blogs, you know that I've recently come to weird head with the word diversity. Not because I think it's a bad word, but because I think it focuses on the wrong part of the process. Right. So for me, diversity is the end. It's what things look like once we have already done the hard work. But we really need to focus on the process. And for me, that process is defined by a commitment to equity, inclusion, and justice. So just so we're clear on what all of those things mean, I'm going to define each for you. When I say inclusion, what I mean is that everybody is invited to the table. Or in this graphic that I spent an inordinately long amount of time trying to come together, everybody is invited to the bar. Right. Now, inclusion is great, right? It suggests open involvement, and it suggests everybody is treated in the same way. Everyone is met with respect. Everyone is met with kindness. But the thing about inclusion is that it only works really, really well when there is a level playing field. If there is pre-existing inequality or systemic injustice, inclusion doesn't ensure that everybody's going to have the same access to opportunities. So yes, what I'm suggesting is that we should be inclusive, and also that might not be enough. And so we add equity. In an equitable situation, not only is everyone invited to the table or invited to the bar, but everyone has the same opportunity to succeed. Now, the thing about equity, as you can see, it requires some investment. There are some costs to bring people who are experiencing systemic injustice up to the level of opportunity of everybody else. And I will tell you a little something about human nature, particularly in 2019. That dude on the left, even though he can totally reach the bar, is going to look to his right and say, "How come they get stools?" Right? It's going to happen. Right? And the interesting thing is, it can be awkward as a business owner or an organizer to provide special programs for special people. Right? It can put you in an ethical dilemma. So equity is also important and part of this process, and even that might not lead to the best outcomes. And so we move towards justice. Right? With justice, instead of focusing on leveling the playing field, instead of focusing on providing special programs for special people, we look to level the playing field. We remove the barrier that caused the problem in the first place. Right? We fire the carpenter who made such a shitty high bar. Right? And we bring it down so that everybody can have the same quality of experience while being their fullest, truest selves. So I think that thinking philanthropically leads us to a question of diversity. And what I want to do today is start with an example and then help you all work through an example of your own. If you've attended one of my talks in the past, you know that I kind of like to do a little hands-on, so be prepared to do a little class participation. So the story I want to start with is about the play pump. Those of you who have already heard about the play pump, shut up and don't ruin the story. The play pump was a technology that emerged in about 2005, and it was a technology that was intended to bring drinking water to thousands of African communities by harnessing the power of children at play. So here's how it worked. Starting at number one, there's a little merry-go-round or roundabout play structure. The kids play on it. They spin it around. And it's connected to a borehole, right, for a well. And it pumps water up from the well. It can go as deep as about 300 feet. And it pumps water into a holding tank. That's number four. And then it just holds it there. So when someone comes along and needs fresh water, number five, they can just use a faucet to dump water that's already waiting. And that tower, number six, has kind of a square structure on top of the holding tank that is actually a billboard so that you can put advertising on it, and the sale of advertising helps pay for the play pump and its maintenance. So the play pump for me is a great example of the first type of relationship that I want to talk about, and that is a transactional relationship. In a transactional relationship, the best case scenario occurs when the investment on the part of philanthropist draws some sort of return. Right. Now, that return might be marketing, that return might be feeling good, that return might be something else, but there's some sort of return, right? The best case is this is a win-win proposition. And in 2005, when people saw the play pump, they saw a really dynamic win-win proposition. In fact, it was so exciting that in 2006, Laura Bush, the First Lady, and Steve Case, who was the founder of AOL, and his wife, who formed the Case Foundation, decided to support Play Pump with a $16.4 million investment. $10 million came from the U.S. government, and the Cases gave the other part themselves. Now, this was a huge rollout, and it got the kind of social entrepreneurship community extraordinarily excited, and everybody jumped in. Before you know it, MTV was there with their cameras, Hove was walking around Africa, there was a concert, and there was a goal to raise $60 million to install 4,000 play pumps across sub-Saharan Africa that would provide clean drinking water to over 10 million people. Now, if we look, that first investment, that initial investment of $16.4 million, that's a lot of money. Right? And the pumps weren't cheap. So they needed to keep fundraising after this, but there was a lot of return that could happen with this investment. Right? 10 million people provided with clean water. And the time and that children and women were spending going and getting water could be spent now in education or providing income to the family. Because at this time, the burden of getting water disproportionately fell on women and girls. In the data that PlayPump put out, the average distance that women and girls crossed to get water in a single day was 5 miles. You also have increased income in these communities, which brings wealth, which brings political stability, right? So there's not, you know, there's not a small reason for Western governments to want to be involved here. And then because of these billboards, two of the sides were reserved for social messages and government messages. There was a way to extend communication networks throughout the region. So with this in mind, I want you to take a moment and do a little bit of an exercise for me. Hopefully everybody at the table has somebody with a piece of paper, a pencil, a computer you can write with, because I'm going to want you all to put your heads together and collaborate. So what I want you to do is come up with some examples, either things that you've seen, things that you've done in your own breweries, or things that you can come up right now with a few minutes of conversation with people. What are some examples of some transactional, win-win philanthropic relationships that we can create in craft beer? A couple examples. I'm going to give you like 3 to 5 minutes. All right, meet your folks at your table, get a couple examples. All right. So what I want you to do is, as a result of the conversations you just had, pull out a couple of those examples and just kind of stick them in your head, write them down, because we're going to work with them going forward. All right? So keep those examples in mind. So the first question I want to ask you as a follow-up is, of the examples that you came up with, do any of those efforts specifically address inclusion, equity, or justice for the population they are intended to reach, as we defined it earlier? I'm not going to give you a quiz. Some of you are going, right. But it's a question I want you to keep in mind and think about. So last fall, I actually started doing some research about philanthropy and advocacy in the craft beer industry, and I sent out this tweet. Some of you might remember it. And almost 200 responses later, I had this really incredible list of causes and charities and other types of advocacy work that our people are doing with their brewing activities. Honestly, it was one of the most uplifting things I've done in a while. It was like the happy spreadsheet. But one of the questions that I wanted to ask was, do any of these efforts specifically address inclusion, equity, or justice in the way that I use them to define work towards diversity? And I would say that many of them do not. Many of them focus on the transaction, the win-win. But something gets lost in the middle. Now, the example that I started with is amazing. At least it sounded amazing. But as they say, the path to hell is paved with abandoned play pumps. Less than 5 years after First Lady Bush and Case Foundation got involved in the Play Pump initiative, it was largely abandoned. And it was thought of as, in some cases, one of the worst philanthropic missteps that has happened kind of in modern history. And in fact, it's a very common business school case. So what I want to do actually is not just harp on the Play Pump, right? But we're going to talk through what went wrong. And while we talk through what went wrong with the Play Pump, I want you to use those examples that you came up with and see if we can improve them. So we started with one type of relationship, which was a transactional relationship, right? A win-win. And what I'm asking you to do fundamentally in this session and after you leave is just change the framing of how you form relationships from transactional to transformative. From transactional to transformative. So, let's start with Play Pump's first issue. They went in with little to no knowledge of the community they were trying to help. They didn't get a good sense of the people, of their surroundings, of the situation, and challenges and opportunities. And so, in a lot of cases, they installed play pumps in places that were hydrologically just not productive for wells. In some places, they installed play pumps where there weren't a lot of young children to play on them. And some places they installed play pumps where they did not ask the people if they wanted a play pump. So there was not a lot of learning on the part of the people who went in. They just saw their really great transactional idea and ran. So my first step for you here is go into these types of things ready to learn. Right? I'll give you a great example. At a recent stop, somebody asked me about brewing a beer that had a lot of South Asian spices in it. And they were like, we want to do a beer that has, you know, some Thai spices or some South Asian flavors, but really worried that might seem kind of, appropriative, right? And is that going to seem like pandering or, you know? And I was just like, you know, have you just gone to, like, a Thai chef for like a South Asian community and just sat around and seen what you can learn. And then just see where it goes from there. And they were like, no. Right. And I was like, you should try that. And I think it's a good step. Right. So what I want you to do is go back to those examples you were talking about and very quickly add a component and say, what could we do to learn about the community, the situation, or the people that this is intended to serve. All right? 1 or 2 minutes, go. If you are struggling for ideas, neighborhood and community associations are a great place to start. Small business associations, heritage groups, educational groups, they're all places that are generally welcoming and happy to share information. Number two, I want you to evaluate the potential costs for everyone. In the play pump scenario, there was a largely improper evaluation of the costs, especially for the community that the pumps were installed in. First of all, the implementation was expensive. Installing a play pump costs 4 times as much as installing a traditional well with a hand pump. So it was an expensive project, even though it was flashy. Second, they didn't have a contingency plan if there were no children who wanted to use the pump as a plaything. So what ended up happening in lots of communities is that grown women and sometimes elderly women had to get on a merry-go-round and try to push it in order to pump water, which was not cool. Right? And because of that, they installed the play pumps over existing well bores, and so most communities lost their original well, which meant the play pump was their only source of water. After 3 years of implementation of play pumps, only 13 were functional by 2009. That means they essentially ruined the only water source for many communities. Improper evaluation of the cost. So again, I'm going to give you a couple of minutes to break out here and add to this discussion of your ideas, what are the associated costs, not only for you as a philanthropist, but also for the community that you are hoping to reach? Can you find any unintended costs, and can you mitigate those with a contingency plan? All right, ready for step three? I know I'm probably cutting off some good conversations, but in the interest of time and Q&A, I'm going to move it along. So the third step I'd like you to take is to plan long term. If we're talking about transformative relationships, we need to remember that relationships persist. They are not just a one-shot event, and then everybody goes home. In the play pump scenario, they had an extraordinarily poor maintenance plan. Though the play pump was a great idea, it had a lot of moving parts, and it required specialized tools to repair. Moreover, because of the lack of instantaneous communication in many of these communities, it was hard for people to let the installers know they were broken, and the installers were so busy trying to reach their 4,000 play pump goal that they didn't do maintenance on the pumps that were broken. So there was no maintenance plan. Moreover, the advertising on the billboard was supposed to pay for the cost of maintenance. But shockingly, capitalist organizations do not want to pay for advertising on billboards of communities of rural farmers in sub-Saharan Africa. And so they did not sell a lot of advertising. So as you are looking at this event that you are working with and workshopping, what I want to ask you now to think about is, how are you going to make sure this relationship persists? How are you going to make sure this is not a one-time shot into the community, and then you leave and everybody feels good, but then nothing really happens? How will you maintain this relationship? For your fourth and last step in this process, I want you to allow for testing, trial and error, and sustainable growth. If there is one biggest problem or one biggest faux pas that Play Pump made, it was scaling up too quickly. They did not allow for a testing period, and when it was clear that they needed one, they decided instead to keep going for those transactional goals. Because the pressure of a $16.4 million investment forces you to focus on ROI. So, again, last few minutes, think about how you can take this project that you're working on in collaborations at your tables and think about it in a model that allows you to test and then scale it up so that it can sustain, rather than go all in, all resources. So as I start to wrap up today, I'm going to say something that maybe is a little controversial for the Diversity Ambassador for the Brewers Association. I want you to stop thinking about diversity. I want you to stop thinking about counting faces or what people look like. And I want you to start thinking about inclusion, equity, and justice. And I want you to frame these things in a model of social sustainability. Social sustainability is a process through which current generations, places, systems, create places, systems, and structures, processes, and relationships that actively promote the capacity of current and future generations to achieve success, well-being, and quality of life. Love of humanity, right? Socially sustainable communities, whether they are neighborhoods or neighborhood breweries, are equitable, connected, democratic, diverse, and contribute to community resilience. You see, instead of the everybody wins goal of a transactional relationship, when we focus on transformative relationships, everybody grows. And I honestly think that's a better way to think about diversity than counting faces or checking boxes. And honestly, for me, this is the best part of the Play Pump story, because it didn't end with their failure. After finally acknowledging that they had a catastrophic problem with their rollout, the Case Foundation made a very candid and humbling apology, and they sold the Play Pump operation to another organization that was ready to put in the type of work that you all engaged in today. And now, as part of Water for the Children, Play Pumps are one among many water delivery solutions, but they are only installed in situations where the community has buy-in, generally near schools with big populations, where they will be effective and they will fit. So if there's something to learn from fucking up really bad, it's that you can learn and everybody can grow. And I've been kind of beating this horn since I first came on with the BA, but I will continue to beat it. Inclusion, equity, and justice drive diversity. And diversity is not special programs for special people. When you do it right, it improves the experience for everyone. So this time I'll take your questions. Please don't be shy, because someone else probably has the same question you do. I will be around afterward if you want to say hello, and obviously we'll be floating around all week and would love to meet as many of you as feel inclined to introduce yourselves. And if you'd like to reach me later, my contact information is here. So, questions? And you'll have to stand up to the mic because they want to hear the questions.
So are there any, and I might have this totally wrong from your last slide, but are there any metrics that you think are worth looking at when it comes to measuring if you're successful or not?
So are you, depends on what type of implementation
sure.
you want to do. But yes, I'm a huge proponent of assessment, so I think most of the things you do should have metrics attached. It just depends on whether you're looking for quantitative or qualitative metrics. People counts are, it depends if you're doing events, right? Just total people counts are great. Money generated is great. Impressions are great. But I tend to be a person who likes qualitative feedback. And so pre and post type of like round table questionnaires where people can kind of air feelings openly about what their expectations are and then whether or not expectations were met, for me, are really like round out that kind of data really nicely. There's a couple other things that are really interesting that you can do with social media as far as like sentiment and engagement. It depends on how much of a social media person you are, but it's things that help you kind of take the temperature of what's going on around your initiative and whether or not it's being received well in the public discourse. So,
cool. Thanks.
Answer your question, hopefully.
Hello. Do you have any examples of a brewery that you think did a really good transformative relationship with a nonprofit as opposed to just a transactional one?
Yes. So I don't name names, even in the positive. But I've seen a lot of really nice relationships. Two recently that have kind of come onto my radar. One, I've spoken about it on the road a little bit, involves a partnership with a senior living community. When we think about diversity, we are often thinking about race and gender, but this is an industry that also has a very tight age demographic, and there is a lot of opportunity to reach older drinkers. And so I've seen some really interesting partnerships that way, particularly that they're cool because the community, the senior living community, was looking for ways to kind of re-engage with their communities because they're kind of geographically separated. So it was giving them a way to kind of get back into things, forms of entertainment, right, things to learn about. But it was actually doing the exact same thing for the people in the brewery who were not, you know, they kind of were like, oh, a little fun, we'll get new customers. But they formed a lot of really interesting relationships with older folks who have lots of experiences and lots of things that people can draw on. So it just kind of ended up spinning out into being like, oh, then we learned this, then we met this, and we met this guy, and he owns this. So it was this kind of relationship that it ended up being win-win, but I think the better part of it is that everybody kind of changed together. So that's one that comes to the top of my head. If you grab me later, I probably can rattle off like 50. And that was a direct relationship. It didn't go through a nonprofit, so that might have been part of what's going there. I went too slow. I was going to ask you guys to share examples if you came up with anything cool at your table. So if anybody actually wants to do that, tell us what you talked about. I would love to hear it. Or if you have more questions. No one? I'm going to see you guys in like 8 hours and you're going to be like drunk and screaming out loud. No one's going to share anything.
Okay, I have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
So let's assume the brewery that you work for is made up of what we know to be the beer industry right now, white straighted male. So we are going to implement this DEI initiative or committee. How can you make sure that you can message it to that audience to make them feel like it is important and necessary and connect with them?
Message your program to the audience it's intended to reach?
To straight white dudes that work at your brewery.
Okay. so... So how do you make the case that it's important? Well, you could download the diversity and inclusion best practice resources that have a couple of reasons, but you can go to Bart's session and learn all of the scary things that are happening in the industry as far as growth and small pies and competition, and tell them that like they can keep fighting for customers that look like them with everybody else, or they could just get new customers, right? So there's a strong financial imperative here that I think, you know, is important, right? Like, look, you're all in the business to make money, right? So let's take the financial imperative seriously. But I think secondarily, lots of us are looking at growth in craft beer in niches, right? You have to be innovative now. You have to differentiate yourself. And it's going to be an asset to expose yourself to as many ideas, perspectives, experiences, and skill sets as possible. It's what really good 21st century businesses do. And then if that doesn't work, you can hit them with the ethical thing, right? Like, it's actually the right thing to do. And I think that's worthwhile, right? We're trying to, you know, hopefully use this industry to be everything that we keep saying it is on Twitter, right? And Bruce said it this morning, you know, he was like, this is about more than beer, right? This is about challenging status quo. This is about improving things we can prove because we can and for no other reason, right? And that's kind of awesome. So, you know, if that doesn't work, just, I can talk to him. just give me their email. Thank you. Any other questions? I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
How does one go about choosing multiple entities to donate to charitably? I know there's some trial and error and lots of research into those entities because some of them have, I guess, programs that certain people don't gravitate towards or policies that or procedures that have maybe given them a discolored sort of perspective for people. They don't believe in what one entity is doing, but they believe in another, even though they're both the similar type of entity.
So I think, you know, there's a good answer in part of what you said, right? Do your homework. But for me, it's about values. You find entities that share your values, not in just what they say they're doing, but how they operate. I always think that's a great way to vet people. But I think what's interesting and what we often don't take the opportunity to do is allow our values to translate across different contexts and settings. So, for example, lots of you are environmentally conscious, and that might be something that's core to your values. And a lot of times when people are giving money or doing philanthropic work about environmentalism, it constantly goes to kind of conservation-type efforts. And what I always kind of remind people of is that, you know, there are environments in urban places too, right? There are organizations that do urban conservation and that do green space preservation, and that's affecting a whole different population that you might be neglecting because you didn't see the way that your values could travel across contexts. So lead with values, do the work, but be creative in your values. I think a lot of people think of their context as their values, but your values are free of your context. You can let them travel.
Thank you.
Thank you.
First of all, thank you for everything. I'm trying to figure out how to phrase this to as a question, so it's just going to be, can you talk about?
Yeah.
I've heard you speak before about, particularly, trying to build inclusivity, trying to build equity and justice, that you're going to fuck it up at some point,
mm-hmm.
and you need to be prepared for that process. And in, hearing the question of, how do you sell this to straight white dudes, there's not only the, people who are hesitant, but there are the people who are, paralyzed by fear of fucking it up. And I think that's true beyond just the straight white guys. But I was wondering if you could talk about kind of how to prepare yourself for that iterative process of, trying to be more inclusionary and then doing it wrong and then trying again.
Yeah, thanks. I think one of the saddest things right now is, with the inevitability of fucking it up, how many people are, ready for that and ready to slaughter you for it. That's tough, right? And I'm not saying people don't need to be held accountable when they make mistakes, but, as an educator, for me, mistakes are how we learn, right? Really, it's how we learn. I tried golfing before. Right, I'm so bad at it. Right? And if I went to the driving range with my brother and expected to make contact with the club and the ball every time, the first time out, he would look at me and be like, "You're a freaking lunatic. Why would you make that expectation?" Right? And so, in a lot of ways, I look at these type of efforts and this kind of standard that we hold that you're not supposed to get it wrong, and I'm like, "That's actually lunatic." Nothing works like that in real life. And so I do think we have to have space to mess it up and get better. There are some structures that I absolutely think people should put in place. One is a crisis communication plan. This is essentially getting some of your messaging ready for when you do get it wrong. Right? It is very hard to do this when you are reacting, especially when the boo birds are out on social media and you're emotionally charged. So having this type of thinking and messaging ahead of time is really helpful. I think transparency in process all the way through is also one of the ways you can kind of avoid this. A lot of times when we talk about problems when they occur, it's a lot of times because either there's miscommunication about intention, right, or something went off track. And transparency not only makes your intentions apparent, it forces everybody to kind of stick with the original goals and narratives. The gentleman over here who asked me about metrics, this is also a really good idea because metrics not only let you figure out whether something worked at the end, they also let you monitor if it's not working like it should work in the middle of the process. And then you can change course before things get catastrophic. It's an unfortunate inevitability, right? But I also think in all of the things that were said this morning in the opening session, for those of you that were there, the importance of unity in the community was top. And I think this is one of those things where being collective and having unity in this community really matters. Right? It really matters because when you're blazing trails, you don't have examples to go by, right? You're forging things yourselves, and you need to have the room and space to learn and grow with each other. Thank you, Colin. Other questions? Yeah?
So I was hanging out with the cool kids at our table. One of the things I was thinking, and yes, it's ripe for a whole bunch of issues and challenges about utilization of spent grain as a foodstuff. So
sure.
I don't even know the name of the neighborhood. It's where all the breweries are, North Vera. You'll screw up the name of the neighborhood. Everybody else tells me 10 times. Well, walking through that last night, there's how many breweries, a lot of spent grain. On the other side of the river, I guess that's Rhino District, the other side of the river, there's a community kitchen that is training Syrian women, women from Central America, on Ethiopian women on community kitchen business practice, how to use food stuff. So what if you took the spent grain? You'd have to dry it out, turn it into flour stuff. From there, you could create an opportunity of people being able to get free spent grain flour for whatever uses. So would that be the local SPCA? They need dog biscuits. Is this this local kitchen that is looking for food stuff for women to learn a trade? Or is it the local food shelter? Because I was walked back to the hotel from there, and there's the local shelter that can use it for food stuff. So you're essentially taking a product that can have a multi-prong usage for a wide range of entities. A lot of challenges with it. Spent grain, drying, we all know that. But could something like that be worked out and utilized on a multi-prong effect? So.
Yeah, there is an organization in Ohio right now, in the Cincinnati area, that does exactly this, except for they work with adults with developmental disabilities rather than immigrant populations, and they make dog treats. But it provides usable job training for people with developmental disabilities. Obviously, it's helping out some of the workers because they don't have to figure out how to do their waste stuff. And they sell dog biscuits to fund the program. So it's already working. I'll think of their name and give it to you if you want. But it's a great organization, family-owned, really cool stuff. So I think we are officially out of time. Yeah? Okay, thank you all today. I really appreciate you coming, and have a wonderful rest of CBC.